ask about Illuminati.
Since the charting of P-Tux,
is it Disney mind control?
Is this MK Ultra Deluxe?
Uncle Disney,
gonna wish upon a star.
Uncle Disney,
you know about to chat far.
Uncle Disney,
be your plan, Pinocchio.
Uncle Disney,
as above, so below.
Pinocchio seeks for a pleasure island, but traffickers need just falling mines. Captain Hook, a lost boy in Neverland, saving kids from Peter Pan's designs. Nemo fails to survive the Barracuda, and that nobody means no one. Snow White never took another breath. Bird Prince, the angel of death has come.
Go Disney,
we go from real to real.
Go Disney,
Bohemian Grove and no more feel.
Go Disney,
ask about to Illuminati.
Go Disney,
we teach a code to everybody.
Go Disney,
go wish upon a star.
Go Disney,
you know not to travel far.
Oh, go Disney,
the new brand Pinocchio. Yeah, yeah.
Go Disney,
hello, welcome to the Occult Disney podcast. The wonderful thing about the Occult Disney podcast is we are the only one, maybe. Actually, I'm not like 100% sure of that. Someone else could be doing this.
Hasn't been taken out by the Disney legal department yet.
Okay, there we go. Hello, if you're listening. this is Matt here. Let's say Matt then. It's a paranoid American there.
See, I don't use my government name because I know they're coming after us.
Yeah. Okay. Well, Matt's a, of course it is on the screen, so whatever, but I could have changed it. StreamYard gave me the opportunity to do that. We're returning to poo. We don't have to think about the blood and honey this time, which is nice. We're just thinking about the Tigger movie, which is only the second poo film, which is kind of, I guess, weird to think of, especially living in Japan. There's just like an explosion of poo all over the place, you know?
Is poo big in Japan?
Yeah. When my wife and I went to the mall last week, and they had this large poo pop-up store. And when my daughter was born, some family friends gave us this massive poo, which it was like bigger than she was till she was like 4 years old. And we finally had to get rid of that one. So that one might come back and kill me. I don't know. I saved these guys from the trash back here with the Cookie Monster. And ironically, Lotso, as I said before, I saved Lotso from the trash. So this is a happy one, I hope. He hasn't murdered me in my sleep yet. So that's good.
Yeah, I was thinking, if you've got a four-year-old pile of poo that's as big as a toddler or bigger than a toddler, you'll probably need to do something with it after a few years.
Should have been changing the diapers, yeah. But one of my favorite pictures is her doing like her tea party, and the poo is clearly much larger than her. So it's just funny.
That reminds me of Drop Dead Fred. I think there's a mud pie scene in there.
I don't think I've seen that since 1991, unfortunately, shortly after it came out. But yeah, I do remember seeing that. Tigger movie, it took me like halfway through to realize if I'd seen it before or not. And I'm going to say the answer was no. I guess, especially in the first part of the movie, there's just so many like poo signifiers. I guess a thing to doing poo stuff is there's a little bit of a sameness to it all, like intentionally, I think. I don't know. How did you feel about watching the Tigger movie?
I was a little bit bored of the animation style, even though I like it. I kind of like it, except for the very end. There's one particular musical number that got really interesting, and we'll talk about that as we get to the like later part of the episode when we get through that. But otherwise, it was very much serviceable, like what you would expect from a Pooh movie. Kind of like, man, it gave me the same impression from the first movie. They kind of have this in joke where they're like, oh God, this is boring. And they kind of like start flipping through the pages really fast. And it always blew my mind. Like, you don't say that part in the movie. It's like someone just paid money to sit down. And now the movie's telling you, like, this is kind of boring. Let's go ahead and speed this up a little bit. And this one did something very similar. Like, it kept slowing down. They kept, like, having you relax and, like, okay, let's stop what we're doing here. Let's sing to the bee. Let's sing a lullaby to the bees for a little bit. Right at the height of action, it was just a lot of weird. And I don't know if it's MK Ultra programming. Maybe it is. Maybe we're all going to go out and assassinate someone after we watch this movie, which would make it more interesting. But that said, I do have a fairly dark take on what this movie might represent.
Oh, I don't know if I have the take you had, but I was definitely feeling dark undercurrents in this, which I guess I'll get to my own end, which I'm guessing is different than yours. We'll find out. this one, we're doing theatrical films. This one was most of the way going to be direct to video.
You feel it. You feel it right off the bat, too.
Yes. For a direct video, it's actually, I would say this is quite fantastic. It's better than most of those. The thing that pushed it into the theater was the demo tapes of the soundtrack, which was the first time that the Sherman Brothers had scored or written songs for a movie since our beloved Bedknobs and Broomsticks. Let's say Boomsticks. I'm thinking of Bruce Campbell or something.
Shout out Angela Lansbury.
Yeah. That was fun. But yeah, I remember that. I mean, if this movie dragged a little bit, that movie dragged a lot. But Eisner heard the demo tape of the songs that were going to end up in the Tigger movie. He was like, oh, we have to put this in the theater. So it was kind of a late choice to do that. I mean, Doug was recently in the theater. That's kind of the same thing for slightly different reasons. I probably had more of the feeling that you had watching Doug's first movie, watching this one, just because I did grow up with enough Pooh, and the 80s had the Saturday morning cartoon, so I see that a lot.
That almost feels insulting. I refuse to believe that you could enjoy anything Pooh related as much as I like Doug. So I think it's a false equivalent.
Well, also keep in mind I didn't watch the proper movie and I saw episodes of the Disney version, so it didn't get like the fair.
I'm working on some idea. I just there's not enough hours in the day, but I really want to start covering like the OG Nicktoons and watch some Ren and Stimpy episodes and just as a reason so I can rewatch it and feel like it's for business. You know what I mean? It's for content. It's not just because I want to rewatch all the old episodes of Doug by Jim Jenkins. Shout out Jim Jenkins.
Hey, that's how I ended up starting like some of my other podcasts. I got this set of the full Twilight Zone. I'm like, well, I'm never going to watch it unless I do just comment on all of them. So
exactly. I've got a bunch of Grindhouse movies too, but
oh yeah.
Yeah. We'll have to talk about that.
I do the Space 1999 one. Cause I'm like, well, the set's been here for like 10 years. I haven't watched all of them. So now I'm going to. So there you go, folks. That's how you start a podcast. Look on your wall for something dense that you haven't cracked yet.
I also think that Pooh and Tigger are more timeless than Doug, maybe. It hurts me to say that because Doug deserves to be a little bit more timeless, but he's very much a 90s kid. And, you know, you would almost expect if you saw Doug again today, he'd have to be an adult or he would be like fish out of water kind of style, whereas Pooh and Tigger and all the other weird MK Ultra puppets, they kind of can be the same age forever, like hundreds of years, and there's nothing in their culture that really changes because they live in the 100-acre forest.
Right. I almost forgot about Christopher Robin until he shows up in the last 5 minutes, you know, which I don't know if that's good or bad for this movie.
He is still the Antichrist. If anything, it reconfirms that he's the Antichrist for me. Okay. This movie does.
My note was he's the Archon, which I guess is like two shades different. But
I'm going to, for the sake of this particular episode, let's just consider Antichrist and Archons and Demiurge all roughly the same thing. They like hang out in the same clique at the lunch table.
Okay. I did sit there when doing my notes just for a second. Archon, Demiurge. I did not think of Antichrist, but maybe that's because I don't live in America anymore and I don't think about, you know, Christ.
I'll pray for your soul. I'll pray for your soul.
In this dark land I'm in.
I can't do the whole family, but I'll pray for yours.
Land of the rising sun. It's dark in the land of the rising sun. That sounds like a nice emo lyric for something.
I always wonder what Freemasons in Japan say. Like, are they still traveling east? Like, because they're already there, right? They're already in the east. So, like, what is there? Anyways, we'll leave that for another episode.
I haven't seen much evidence of that in Japan. I have seen a lot of lions.
What Japanese stuff. Freemasons?
But, well, I'm just wondering, it probably takes a different form. But I've noticed lots of lions clubs, so that did make it here. I mean, visibly, you know. I haven't seen a lodge anywhere, but I've seen lots of lions, which I don't know much about it. I feel like that's something somewhat tangentially related.
If I can find you the location of a Japanese lodge and it's not too far, would you go and grab some video of it? We can expose them?
Sure. I found the in downtown Tokyo near Shibuya, I found the Scientology skyscraper a few years ago. That was pretty exciting. I think I have a photo of that somewhere.
Did you go inside?
No, I thought they'd want me to like walk, you know, start talking to me about Dianetics or something, which I
they absolutely do.
Yeah. Also, I was like on a like guitar search that day, so I was trying to hit all the guitar stores. So I didn't have time for the Scientologists that day.
They are very welcoming and impressive. They look like, I mean, before Apple Store was around, a lot of Scientology centers were kind of like an Apple Store. Like they would just have books kind of set up and big windows that you could kind of see what was. I don't know, that they always were very appealing to me, and the name, and I didn't even know what Scientology was really until South Park. Like, I'm not afraid to admit that South Park.
That's true for a lot of people.
Yeah.
I'm surprised. I'm sure they're on their poo list. But you know, Trey Parker, Matt Stone. Okay. I was like trying to jumble jamble their names there. I'm sure they're not liked by several religions at this point, or cults or whatever, the in betweens. I don't know. I guess that, you know, every cult becomes a religion if it lasts long enough.
They set the bar pretty high, yeah.
I am wondering, of course, infamously now, this is the year 2000 when this movie comes out, but I think Tigger is not part of the Pooh is now a public domain dump. Like, Tigger gets several extra years for copyright. I wonder if this was kind of setting that up a little bit. Maybe we can put Tigger more as like the front man. So, you know, in terms of marketing, we can control him completely for a couple extra years.
How much longer does he have?
Probably not that much longer, so I'm thinking they didn't actually make much use of it. But I was just like wondering if that's a thought, why they'd go straight to doing the Tigger movie. Or is Tigger just that popular? I mean, I'm not sure. But he is a slightly later creation. I do know that. So,
well, I mean, so I've got, I don't even think this is a conspiracy theory. I think this is just how life works, and like how business works. But kind of how Marvel comic books and DC comics, for the longest time, even today, but for decades, some of the books that they put out were loss leaders. Like, they would lose money on it or maybe break even, but there was so many different things that they could be investing their money in other than the whole distribution and production and printing and, you know, the whole rollout of these physical printed comics that basically sell for a very low profit margin. And the reason that they do that is because that's what builds up the IP and the affinity for the IP for people to go and buy the Happy Meals and the shirts and the sneakers and the backpack and, you know, all of the things and the Funko Pops. And people wouldn't necessarily want to go and buy that crap unless it was established in these comics first, even if no one read the comics, just knowing that it was like, oh, you know, this has this background. So I think that there's a similar aspect here with the Tigger movie, where Tigger clothes and Tigger accessories and stuff, they probably sell really, really well. So in order to just keep perpetuating that like IP energy to translate it into money, you know, like it's a currency. And that's kind of what the reason of having Tigger movies and all these other movies are. It might not even be that they wanted to make money on the movie itself. They just want to keep pumping those t-shirts.
This one actually is surprisingly successful. The budget was, it says 15 to 30 million, which seems like a pretty big window. That's like, that's okay, whatever. Maybe that counts for marketing. I don't know. But the box office is 96.2. It's almost 100 million. If it made like another five in the year 2000, I think this would actually be considered like a big Disney success, which, but yeah, you're like, wow, they made bank on this. So there are definitely things that are IP pushes. I mean, and the era of streaming, how much more of that are we seeing? You know, not even a conspiracy, that's business. But
I'd love to know how much like Tigger related merchandise was sold in a similar time period, and if it's even comparable to the box office sales.
See, I was on the other side of the mall aisle. Actually, by this time I wasn't working there, but like 1997, 98, I was working at the Warner Brothers Studios store at Lenox Square in Atlanta, and like right across the way, this may be slightly down the mall, but yeah, there was a Disney store. So we always thought we should like, you know, get into combat with them, you know, like tie effigies of Mickey Mouse burning in front of their door and stuff. So just for fun. But
educational purposes.
Yeah. I'm trying to remember if I remember seeing a bunch of Tigger stuff at the time, but I wasn't paying that much attention.
Well, Tigger and Pooh have always been like kind of staples in Disney fashion. Like I think I've always seen, maybe it's because I've been in Orlando and Florida for a lot of that, but just people wearing, you know, pajama pants with freaking poo all over them. Or I love how easy it is to work that into normal phrases.
It's like when I did the movie The Thing. It's, you know, the thing about it, that happens like every 2 minutes. So that's going to probably happen.
Oh, God, that should be the next open source or public domain movie. It would just be like Poo and The Thing.
Well, let's see, 1950 for Thing from Another World. So another 25 years and it's all in public domain. Yeah.
Maybe, I mean, with AI, you don't even have to wait. Now anyone can do it pretty soon.
Yeah, true. Or you just have generic monster if you really do have to worry about copyrights and stuff. Where were we? Yeah, I was going to say in Japan, I do remember more Tigger stuff in the States. Like Japan doesn't seem to care about Tigger as much, even though he has a very cool bouncy room at Tokyo Disneyland. So.
Are there tigers in Japan?
Or just in the zoos? Just in the zoo. If you've seen pictures of shrines, there's often kind of the tiger liony things at the gates.
Right. That's why I was asking that. But were there ever native like ligers or tigers on Japan itself, or was that just decorative from something someone saw elsewhere?
That's actually kind of why it's interesting. It's something someone saw elsewhere who told someone else who told someone else, and now they're creating this creature like on like third or fourth hand knowledge, you know.
I like that giraffes. Kind of like the medieval horse paintings where it's like no one had ever seen a horse from a certain angle, so they just draw like a happy face on it.
Yeah, that's what those are. And you know, those ended up often looking cooler, you know. Those Okinawan lions look awesome, you know. But yeah, that's, but it was passed down information. Giraffes, there's the older Japanese stuff has a bunch of very bizarre giraffes because of the same thing. So
what about Piglet? Do any of the other characters other than Pooh get any love in Japan, or does Japan just love Pooh?
I've seen a little bit of Piglet. Girls in Japan sometimes like decide they love pigs, which I feel like in the States, that, you know, you think of like, oh, that's the fat girl, right? Where they don't seem to care about that in Japan. So there are a lot of girls that are into pigs. I've seen kids with, you know, piglet socks and stuff. And by kids, I mean like high school students.
Yeah, I mean, the complete tangent, but related to Piglet, I guess. But there's a show that I got sucked into watching with my girlfriend. It's like one of those 90-day fiance shows or something. And this Korean guy starts calling his fiance Piggy. And when he goes to the States and he calls her that in front of her whole family, like they're shocked, like they can't believe it. And they're like, why do you call our daughter Piggy? Like, what does Piggy mean? He's like, oh, you know, Americans are fat. And like, it's so like off the cuff. but I guess like the phrase, like no one really finds it offensive in Korea. And I would assume outside of the United States. And it actually kind of means like cutie pie, or, you know, like puppy love or something. Like calling someone Piggy is a cute thing. But yeah, it's funny how certain words take on different connotations. You can't call anyone Piggy in the States and have anyone take it the right way, I think.
Yeah, yeah. So that's why it was like kind of shocking that was a bunch of teenage girls like power animal or whatever. I don't or infatuation animal. I don't know what's the right term there. But what are some other ones that are real big in Japan? Marie, which would be Marie from the Aristocats, I think I mentioned back then, has a weird.
That still blows my mind. I don't get that. I don't want to get that.
They just think the cat's cute, I think.
I guess, yeah. Okay.
It's like Hello Kitty, right?
Yeah. Fair point.
So and then of course Disney Sea has Duffy Bear, which are you familiar with Duffy Bear?
I have no idea what Duffy Bear is.
Duffy Bear is Tokyo Disney Sea's sort of main mascot character. I mean, they got plenty of Mickey and stuff, but they have Duffy Bear, and Duffy has like three or four friends. So I'm actually going to Disney Sea in a few weeks, and I was just saying to my daughter, what do you want? Because I'm going with my coworkers. And at first she said one of Duffy's friends, and then she's like, no, every girl gets that. That's cliche. Give me something else. I think she just wants chocolate in the end. So I appreciate that.
You should
that,
get her a Tigger. You could start a whole new trend.
Maybe. Well, yeah, it'll be in the wrong park for the Tigger, but they might sell stuff there too. Yeah.
if you ask someone for Disney merch, I don't know, actually, maybe they will send you the other park, because they're like, oh, yeah, that's kind of part of the reason you got to buy the ticket for that park. So you can go buy stuff there.
Oh, in Tokyo for sure. Cause they're really into like limited edition, you know, like specific stuff. That's just the Japanese thing, right? That it's like convenience stores. Don't get too hooked on to any kind of snack or something, because it's not going to be there a few months later, most likely.
It's like research chemicals. They always have to stay two steps ahead of the authorities.
Oh my god, yeah. And as far as like synthetic drugs in Japan, that was like extremely a thing, where they were just going two steps ahead. And of course, each one seems to actually, the original ones didn't seem that dangerous, but each iteration it's like seems worse, because they're trying to find new loopholes, and it makes it worse, I guess, you know.
It would be pretty sweet if they offered those in the Disney parks, like you get like your Disney themed research chemicals.
Well, I had my best trip to Epcot in 2008, where my friend had like pharmaceutical CBD, and that's a great way to go to Epcot.
Just CBD pills?
I mean, they had like some psychoactive stuff in there too, so I enjoy Journey into Your Imagination featuring Figment. That's how it did that much. Okay.
well we have to be very specific here, because the original Figment that I remember, but I'm talking like 80s Figment. That Figment was unbelievable. And then over the years, they kept making it like worse and worse, to the point where it was like cringy. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah. No, that's what I'm telling you, that they worked well enough that I enjoyed the most recent version.
Oh God, I don't even believe that.
Another time I had ridden that beforehand, and you'll never get those brain
cells back. You'll never get those brain cells back. Those are shot.
I won't. They are shot. Yeah. Mexico is fantastic. Yeah, yeah. That was a fun time. Yes, where were we here? Okay. I should focus on this movie a little bit. I guess there's not that much to focus on as far as just like story. I mean, it's pleasant. It's three steps above Saturday morning cartoon, I guess. But three steps under actual feature animated film. Does that seem accurate?
Yeah, I mean, it definitely has a lot of care put in, because there's a very real feeling of that hand-drawn cell animation. There's a few scenes that it gets a little bit more digital, but it definitely feels, and I don't know if that's just really good technology and it was all just done like in a weekend. I'm sure it wasn't, because it had a pretty big production budget, especially for what was originally a direct-to-video. But I think that it looks great. Like, there's no point in the movie that stands out and like is jarring. It doesn't have the sloppiness of some of that Xerox to 101 Dalmatians, and it also doesn't have over the top leverage of like kind of early 3D that you would see in, I don't know, like Hunchback, where they look okay, but it doesn't hold up as well. Like this one, they do really well with the timeless look, again, except for this one little clip, which is my favorite one in the whole movie.
Yeah, hopefully I'm not building the 2011 one up too much. I like this better than the one they put out in the 70s. I don't like it as much as the 2011 one, which I, again, hopefully I'm not building up too much, but we'll get to that eventually.
In a couple of years, we'll get to
it. Yeah, a couple of years, we'll get to that. Yeah, and there's more poo before that, too. I think,
auditioned the poo out left and right.
That's right, poo for everyone. 2003, 2005 have theatrical releases that I guess we're going to cover. So
they drop a poo every 2 years.
Yes, yes, which is not very regular. They should see a doctor, but it's been 2 years, man. So I guess my take is I usually come in more from the production aspect, but of course I'm thinking about what am I seeing here, and I'm like, this is like the entire town decides to gaslight someone who then in turn responds by gaslighting themselves even harder, which is, I mean, I guess that gets back to the weird, like, oh, everyone in Pooh represents some kind of mental condition, you know, which you can do that with most things, I think. But this one is just weird that, like, they're making it takes 2 seconds to realize that plan is terrible with the letter for anyone. So they've dug their own hole, which they literally do in the 2011 one, I believe. But they dig their old hole, and then Tigger pushes himself in it even harder in the end, you know?
Yeah, so spoiler alert, but the premise of the Tigger movie is essentially Tigger's whole theme song is about how great it is to be a Tigger because he's the only one. And that's like literally part of the chorus. But then he starts somehow like reminiscing because they go to Owl, and Owl talks about his whole family tree, and he's got aunts and uncles and brothers and sisters and everything. And Tigger starts thinking like, well, do I have a family tree? And he's not sure. And he starts looking around and he becomes depressed. Like, he visibly and audibly, he basically says like, I am now a manic depressive and I'm thinking about ending things, and all of his friends are trying to talk him out of it, and he basically settles on, I have to go and find my family tree, I got to go and find where my family's at, where are my roots. And in order to prevent him from leaving the 100-acre forest, all of the characters get together and they decide to collectively gaslight him. Rue suggests they write him a letter from his family, and that the way that he says it, it's like, we will write to him as us, but from his family. And they all get, and not a single person says, hey, this might not be a good idea to, you know, pretend that we are his family in this very vulnerable state. They're all on board. They're like, what a great idea. So they write this letter to him. They send it to Tigger. And when Tigger reads it, he takes it that they're going to be coming visiting him. He believes it. He's like, oh, all my Tigger family is going to come and visit me. So he starts decorating and like getting real hyped about it. And no one really has the balls to kind of break it to him that it's all fake. So they double down on this gaslight, and they all dress up as Tiggers. They like put on little Tigger costumes and suits. And then Rue accidentally gets his Tigger face ripped off. And that's when Tigger realizes that it was all just like a big scam, and they kind of lash it away. It was like, oh no, you know, you're actually in the family. This was the family the whole time. So it's just like gaslight after gaslight after gaslight. But that's the sugar-coated premise of this movie. That's the good version.
And I was thinking watching it, we've already mentioned Christopher Robin a little bit. So I'm like, well, I guess everyone has exactly the same position intact because they're all being manipulated by the same kid. So why would he disagree with himself even among the characters?
Well, and he laughs, bro. I don't know if you notice this, but when he finds out why all this commotion, because he basically comes down and he's like, what have you guys been doing? And they're like, oh, you know, Tigger's upset because he wants to find his family. And Christopher Robbins laughs in a way that only like an Archon would laugh, knowing that like, oh, you're trying to access the sixth dimension. Like, oh, you poor, you know, mortal beings. That's kind of the feeling that I got from Christopher Robin when he enters this movie.
And that's kind of actually a cool trick of the movie, which I don't know if it was intentional or not, but that you basically do forget about him until the very end when he shows up and laughs at the whole thing. Like a power mad god.
That's who he is, man. And there's something else that I noticed in this movie that I wanted to bring up because I don't know where else it fits in. But in the scene where they're in Kanga or in Rue's room at Kanga's house, Kanga or Rue has a stuffed rabbit in his room. And it just blew my mind a little bit because there's also like the rabbit in the 100-acre forest is also a stuffed animal to Christopher Robin, right? But like, what about this stuffed animal that is like an actual object owned by Rue, who himself is a stuffed animal? It's weird. It's like the Pluto and Goofy sort of conundrum.
Russian nesting dolls, yes.
And this is all building to a theory that the Tigger movie, and I really don't feel like this is much of a stretch, is MK Ultra mind control programming.
Except they did it just with a letter. I mean, if we're talking about in story, if you're talking about wider range, let's do that, of course. But yeah, I was like thinking, well, if this is kind of like a, they've like altered Tigger to now feel like he has this family, it doesn't exist. They did it with a letter, you know, they didn't need all the expensive NASA, you know, techniques and stuff.
Well, kind of. I think it's dual layer. So they're doing it in the movie, but they're also doing it to the viewer at the exact same time. So I guess the dark version of this is that Tigger and all the other stuffed animals that live in 100 Acre Forest, these are all kidnapped mind control slaves, every last one of them. And basically what's happening is that Tigger starts realizing, like, he's waking up out of the matrix a little bit, and he's like, wait a minute, I've got a real family. Like, no one, you guys aren't my family. I was kidnapped and put here by the Archons and forced for you to be my family, almost, you know, like a big, they were all being trafficked in the same container, essentially. And that's what the 100 Acre Forest is. I think it is this private research lab. Maybe it's above ground, maybe it's underground, I don't know, but it's essentially this contained space that you can't let anyone exit. So the whole reason that everyone's on board immediately is because they realize, like, we have to keep him here. And I'm thinking, is everyone else in on it in the 100 Acre Forest? Is Pooh in on it, Piglet, Owl, or are they just also victims and Christopher Robin is the real programmer? Is like, who's the Sidney Gottlieb CIA agent running the operation here? So I mean, Christopher Robin's the easy one, but then I start thinking, well, maybe it's Owl, because Owl's the one that plants the idea of this whole family tree into Tigger's head. And he also has this like British aristocracy to him that makes me feel like, you know, he's in on it. Like, he might have more access to Christopher Robin does. But imagine what he's going through. Tigger's like, I have a real family outside of this compound. I need to escape this compound and find my real family. And immediately everyone's like, no, we can't let him go. Like, we have to convince him that he's part of this family. It's very cultish. I mean, Scientology-esque, right? Like, it doesn't matter who your blood family is. Like, your real family is the one that you've been growing up with and the one that shares all the same programming that you do. So that's a little tiny little glimpse of how I started looking at this movie because of how this operated. Like, yeah, Tigger should have a real family. It doesn't make sense that he doesn't have one and Rue has a mom, because that's where I think Rue is like, don't you have a mom, Tigger? And he's like, that's what kind of like breaks his programming for a small moment.
I just want to throw out one reason, because I podcasted this last year, is that another thing on my wall, you basically just described the 1967 series The Prisoner.
Right,
exactly the plot of that, which is, you know, it's kind of fun. Let's draw a line between the Tigger movie and The Prisoner. I'm all for that, because what I had beforehand was drawing a line between this and Muppets from Space, which is Gonzo being the only one and reaching out to find his family.
That's like the new Adam Sandler movie.
Is that?
I don't know if you haven't seen it yet. That would pair up with the Gonzo in Space really well.
Oh, okay. Now, I haven't seen an Adam Sandler movie in a long time. I mean, I just assume he's making them to as an excuse to visit like Hawaii and stuff these days.
Well, that's when he visited Space.
Yeah, paid trip with 30 of your friends in Hawaii for a month, and you're already loaded. You know, sounds good time. Maybe, I don't know. Maybe it's a bad time, but he keeps doing it, so. It's hard to tell. So yeah, when you're talking about Al, I'm thinking, oh, like in The Prisoners, there's a ever changing number two who maybe is a prisoner of the village as well. Maybe is connected to the actual British, you know, intelligence or someone else's intelligence. It's never really clear who's running the village in that show until the last episode, which the last episode is one. It's one of those things where, well, that could be a fever dream or a ruse as well, you know.
Well, and there's more meat to this than just like kind of flippant casual observation, right? So the owl, as he's showing his very British and maybe like leaning on Scottish family tree, because there's a dude that's kind of wearing to the nines the whole like golf outfit, like you know, he's got the golf hat and the pulled up pants and the whole thing. And there's like 20 other people that are on this wall. But I'm just thinking, if this is a timeless movie, and the first one came out in the 70s, but even that 70s version, Christopher Robin could have been in like the 1900s or something. I don't know. Is there an official period in which Christopher Robin actually lives in the original movie?
I always kind of put it in like, you know, the mid 20s
because okay.
that's where the books are from. And I don't feel like any, well, of course the dumb horror movie broke that, but I don't think any of the Disney films at least have like breached that pocket of time.
So let's even assume 40s just to give it like lots of breathing space. I agree that 20s is probably a good one. 20s, 30s, let's just say 40s for the sake of error. If you were talking to someone in the 1940s and they're talking about their grandpa or their, you know, their great uncle and they're playing golf, we're probably thinking like 1880s or ish, right? Like it's 19th century at least, mid to late 19th century. And the type of person that was actively playing golf at that point is very high up on the social scale. You don't have a lot. In fact, a lot of golf courses wouldn't even allow you to join unless you were a Freemason or a Master Mason. And that's kind of the origin of a lot of like the very first golf clubs, is that you had to be part of like an actual other club. And then over time they started letting non-Masons in, and then it kind of turned into this other type of like highly secretive, a very like you'd have to join and have someone else recommend that you join. You can't just like show up and knock on the door and give them a check. So that whole aspect kind of shows the owl comes from this long line of, you know, fancy pants aristocracy in some way. And he also is the only one that has this list of books he can read. I don't think anyone else within the 100-acre forest even pretends to read. Cause I think in the first movie, he like pretends that he knows what he's talking about, but he kind of doesn't, but he actually has access to all these books. So now this movie's making me think, was he gaslighting them before and pretending that he couldn't read just so that they wouldn't catch on that he could read because he's part, I don't know. Like that's, my mind was going wild from
I
this.
I did that to my mom when I was 3 years old. I learned to read very young and no one else in my class could read. So I felt like I wasn't supposed to be able to read. And then my mom found me secretly reading a book like behind the couch or something. I was like reading in secret because I was like, well, kid, you know, people my age can't read. So.
and she found you with the Anarchist Cookbook as the rest of that story.
That's a good children's book. Now, my spelling's not great. I would also spelled Australia, AWSRAYYLIA. And, I noticed that. I didn't think about it too hard, but did you make any notes on the fact that it's Australia? I don't know if that factors in, but
I don't know if that one was showing that we're in Australia. The 100-acre forest is that actually
that's in Rue's bedroom,
right? Well, and that made sense just because Rue is a kangaroo.
They're from Australia. Okay. Map. Let me punch myself in the head a few times. Sorry.
Yeah, I think, but here's what did kind of freak me out is that Kang is the only female in the entire franchise, or the only reoccurring like main character in the entire franchise that seemingly lives in this 100-acre forest. And that almost puts Kang as like the madam if we're going with this like trafficked MK Ultra mind control slave angle. And that's where Rue first says like, hey mom, you know, I mentioned to Tigger that where's his family, and now he's really upset. And she immediately goes into damage control mode and she's like, oh honey, no, we're his family. We have to remind him that we are his family. There is no family outside of 100-acre forest. I'm paraphrasing a little bit, but that's the sentiment that she immediately gives him. So that's when he gets the idea of maybe we should go to Owl, and since Owl's the one that can write, he's the only one that can read and write, he'll write this letter, which also is like, now if he writes the letter and Tigger can like read it, it kind of violates some of the consistency in the first movie where like no one can read because they go to Owl for information. Anyways.
If they're all tied to Christopher Robin, though, we could say in the first one, Christopher Robin is maybe 4 years old, cannot right, read yet. Can't read Christopher Robin's now 6 years old. He's learned to read a little bit. So now the animals can read, or the toys can read, or whatever.
So that, I mean, I think that part is really interesting because Kang, as the only female, would have the role as kind of being the madam of whatever this unit of mind control slaves are. So she immediately does damage control. Because she's also the only real mother, I would assume, in this entire series. like no one else has any sort of lineage. Like Piglet doesn't, we don't hear about Piglet's family tree in this movie or the last. We don't hear about Pooh's family tree. We don't hear out anyone's except for Owl. And then the obvious one, which is Kang and Roo. And then that leads me down an even bigger rabbit hole of like, is there procreation within this world? And that's where Christopher Robin laughs, I think, when they mentioned that Tigger's looking for his family tree. Cause he's like, oh no, like you guys are created. You know, you are manifested from the Archons. Like humans create you guys and put you into this world. And it's kind of silly that you would think that you actually have parents, and none of that is said out loud. It's all said in that little chuckle that he gives them.
I'm just spoiling myself a little bit by looking at a plot description of Piglet's big movie, which I'm just seeing if Piglet has a family or anything in it. Like they go with this, and it does not look like that's going to be the case. So theory right, holds. Well,
that would make sense, because if this were indeed the message of this movie is to forget about your real family, you've like this is your family now, then they shouldn't ever have to address that again. Like this is the canon. And okay, so then the second layer of this, where I think it gets a little bit more nefarious, is that if you imagine this movie, why does it exist? Why does the Tigger movie even exist? It was a financial success, maybe. Who knows how much of that came from like Epstein funding to make the sales figures look really big. But if you did have a whole trafficked, you know, cargo ship full of kidnapped people, you could play this thing on a loop. And the whole message is like, forget about your family. We're your family now. The people that are in your immediate vicinity, that becomes your family, and don't think outside of that.
Do you think perhaps since we found the Disney proxy was losing a little steam in some of the recent movies, this one actually might have gone to theaters? Just be like, we need to press that button a little harder. The message is slipping a little bit.
But yeah, because the premise again is like, you're alone, your family's gone. You might have never even known where your family was at, but it's okay, because you've got these IP characters to get you through all this.
I mean, because Eisner being like, oh, gee, the Sherman Brothers made some good songs for us, let's put it in the theaters, does sound like a pretty lame excuse.
And as soon as you said that, I was like, man, there's really no songs in here that I can imagine like singing. Like, there's some really depressing songs in here. Like, who's driving to work listening to Tigger being depressed in their car? I feel like that person might be driving into like a wall or something. Like they might be steering into your lane, you know, quote unquote, on accident.
Well, I watched the movie last night, and I woke up with B-52 songs stuck in my head. So not songs from the Tigger movie. So I guess, I mean, nothing here is too bad. You know, speaking of Journey into Imagination, I think the Sherman Brothers wrote the original song for that, which you no longer get to hear.
It's all serviceable. The whole movie, the soundtrack, it's all serviceable, which also helps with, it doesn't go over the top in any regard. It's not like subpar and it's not above par. It's kind of just like par for the course, which spoonful is the perfect place to sneak that subtle programming in.
Yeah, that's a spoonful of sugar, right?
It has been
very directly referenced. Was Mary Poppins also the Sherman Brothers? I think it might have been. So maybe that's their place in the company. Journey into Imagination. What other song? They've did a few other songs for some of the rides, but yeah.
I mean, I'm curious. I don't know if I can take my tinfoil hat off completely and remove myself from the bias, since I've just been like a lifelong conspiracy theorist. But I would love to know from a completely objective outside observer, if you pitch them this idea that, hey, this movie is quite literally about an entire town gaslighting somebody into not trying to go out and find their family, right? Is that in any way like painting it in a false or hyperbolic light? That feels like that's the objective plot of this movie.
It's definitely the reading into it. That's the weird thing. Like a lot of things conspiratorial, I think, happen because people are stupid, not because they're smart. So, but the universe is pretty smart. So on a subtle level that the person writing the movie doesn't understand, I think that could absolutely be coming through. I've written a lot of songs in my life, and you know, I got into reading metaphysical books and stuff in 2017 or something. And I went back and listened to songs I had written in like 2012. I'm like, this is explaining the stuff the books told me, you know, how did I get that? So on that level, I'm like, that could be what's happening in this movie, even if the writer would be like, no, that's crazy.
Well, so, I mean, I want to get a little woo-woo on this because to expose my inner thinkings, I don't know if I've ever really gone into this angle here, but I kind of do believe that over time, intent matters so little. Like, and I'll keep myself from going on my whole intent tangent, but the whole point being that the conspiracies don't necessarily have to mean that someone sat down in the writer's room and they were like, we're going to write an MK Ultra programming script, or we're going to write a script about gaslighting someone to not find their family. That may have never been the intent, but it was the outcome regardless of that intent. And I feel like outcomes are easier to discuss objectively because we'll never I don't think we will ever be able to figure out equivocally what someone's intent was, because the person can even lie about the intent. They can be lying to themselves about the intent. Like, they might not know what ultimately drove them to do something or write a thing or commit a certain action, even if they think they did. So that means intent is a little bit off the table in my mind when it comes to conspiracy theories. So now you're left with either they actively did this, they passively did it because of just their outside environment and inspiration, or that the original Fantasia Disney spell truly created this Disney aggregor, and the Disney aggregor is what's driving the ship at this point. Like, you have no control over it. The fact that you're employed by Disney and taking their money and fueled by their energy and on their property and surrounded by other Disney employees going through the same experience means that the Disney aggregor is just using you as its little fingertips. And part of that is implementing the Disney proxy and implementing these reoccurring themes of being abandoned by your original family and adopting a new family that is fully comprised of intellectual property owned by Disney. Like, that concept, I think, is like baked into people's brains at this point, especially around 2000, because now you've got 2, 3, 4 generations of people that have grown up with Disney, and now it probably has a bigger impact than your great-great-grandpa ever will have on you. But Disney will have that impact.
No, of course I wouldn't be here if I didn't want to talk about the woo-woo version a lot. We could take it just to say partly what you said, and partly corporate culture, that making Fantasia created this studio where there's a certain corporate culture, certain expectations. That's why the CIA was very able to, you know, influence like quote-unquote neutral news sources. You know, you send a few people in to change the environment, make people, oh, we do it this way, don't we? So especially in Disney Studios, it's we do it this way, we do it this way. And that bakes in. And the longer you're there, like a cot, you know, the more you're doing it without thinking about it. The first company I worked for when I worked in Japan, which I guess I'll be nice enough not to name. I mean, they're not the worst or anything, but, you know, in the training is you go to their training center and stay there for like 2 weeks, and it feels like a indoctrination, you know? And then I worked at a branch school, but you could still feel that this weird cultishness coming from the head office, and the people that worked at the head office are, you know, completely submerged in it. So they probably, do they believe what they're talking about? I don't know. You know? So
does it matter? Again, I would go
does
back.
It matter?
Does it matter?
If, does it matter if the writer knows what's baked in, or if that's just like, this is how we do things here, you know?
Right. Or even like the corporate shill, right? Does it matter if they are fully towing the company line in their mind as well as in public? I think it only matters what's happening in public at that point.
Yeah. I mean, you know, first 25 years of my life, I was like, oh, it doesn't matter what I'm thinking. It just matters what it does. I can think as whatever horrible things and get pissed at people, and eventually you're no, actually what I'm thinking matters just as much as what I'm doing, really.
Well, what you're thinking is going to influence what you're doing, but what you're doing is the only thing that will ever really leave a record for now, until the nanobot AI can then just know what you're thinking, and then we're all kind of screwed.
I guess that's the thing, that the shill, or the person unintentionally making content with, you know, deeper layers, is it, in that case, it only matters what they're doing. They've possibly split, like I had when I was earlier, here's thinking, here's doing. They don't have to be connected, right? Which I guess a person actualizing kind of requires, you know, we'll say yolking, like yoga, yolk it together, right? It's all one thing now. So that's how you function. And hey, it could be, so the guy writing the Tigger movie could be the most enlightened dude in the world, and or lady, I don't remember who wrote it, and knew exactly what every layer was coming out as. That's also possible. The person who wrote this could be like a subtle genius as well.
Well, they could have come over on the Nazi rat lines through Argentina into America, and you know, we're now are actually working on the next iteration of mind control. Like, that's a non-zero possibility, although it's slim, but it's not 0%.
Let's see. Directed and screenplays by the same person. I'm just a little curious. And of course, I'm sure multiple people had their hands.
Let's put them on blast. Let's go ahead and put this person out there. We're going to dox them right now.
Let's check. Graduated from the USC School of Cinematic Arts with a bachelor's in live action production in 1991. Not animation. Okay. Works on a lot of movies, but it looks like this is the only like direct. Oh, no. Directed earlier on and later on just has supervising roles. That's kind of interesting. Okay. Mickey's Once Upon a Christmas, Winnie the Pooh Season of Giving, A Winnie the Pooh Thanksgiving, Scooby-Doo and Arabian Nights. Okay. Was the director Curious George during pre-production, but pulled from the movie over script differences. I mean, no smoking guns, but things that could certainly be things, you know?
Was that Scooby-Doo and the Arabian Nights as like
that? No,
was
Scooby-Doo in Arabian Nights. Which
I want to see that now. That 1994. Sounds awesome.
Okay, I could tangent that a bit and have a look here. Once again, I'm sure I saw this box. Yes, actually, now I recognize the box. I used to work at the Warner Brothers Studio Store, so like that looks.
I remember
like
the familiar Popeye version of Arabian Nights, which is one.
That's great. That's the classic Fleischer one. Yeah,
yeah, Max Fleischer. Yeah, I don't know if you've noticed this, but I follow Fleischer Studios or whoever the hell's running Fleischer at this point. They're trying to make a comeback. They're like remastering a bunch of their old animations. They're sort of teasing a bunch of new releases, all from that classic Fleischer catalog.
No, my dad's personal hero seems to be classic Popeye for whatever reason. So he had
the older men.
I remember men. Yeah. Let's see on the Scooby-Doo and Arabian Nights. Features appearances by Scooby-Doo and Shaggy in wrap-around segments. The bulk of the special is devoted to two tales, one featuring Yogi Bear and Boo Boo Bear, and the other starring Megilla Gorilla. So it sounds like kind of a bait and switch movie.
Yeah.
Scooby-Doo, now you're spending time with Yogi Bear, which
I'll spend time with Yogi Bear.
I'll spend time with, yeah, but it doesn't look like it's straight up. Scooby-Doo and Shaggy arrive in Arabia on a magic carpet to become royal food tasters for the young caliph. Okay, sounds like none of the other mystery gangs here, so that's also a bummer.
And also, royal food tasters implies poison. Like that. That's
yeah,
the
I know.
Only reason for a royal food taste. So I mean, that's intriguing.
But yeah, they're the only folks from the. From the mystery gang. And I guess they couldn't, you know, it's a plane, expensive plane ticket to Arabia in the past. So anyway.
Well, and also, if you're ever going to have a food tester or like experiment on someone, you just use the drug addicts. Like those are expendable.
That's right. Yeah. I just watched Akira Kurosawa's High and Low, where they go through the opium alley, and that's kind of like implied, like we can just push through these people like nothing because they're already dead, which I don't know, it seems a little presumptuous to just assume, but
well, I think it's well, yeah, that part of that is just like feeling superior to drug addicts, but also if they're completely zonked out on opium, they probably don't care either. Like even if you're pushing them out of the way, like they don't care, they're not offended, it doesn't even hurt. In fact, it probably, like, just that small, brief introduction of pain is probably pleasurable, because then the opium rushes back in and gives them, like, a new dopamine release. So it's almost like you're doing a
I think
pain.
That might be referenced in that sequence, too, by the way. Because okay. There's one woman just contorting in, like, seemingly impossible ways. Oh, by the way, June Falkenstein is actually a lady. There's only, like, one, you can't see it, there's one short paragraph on Wiki, and there's one pronoun, so... But now I'm like, oh, they let her direct a bunch of stuff and then they didn't. That seems kind of rude. Yeah, supervising director. Anyway, there's not a much information here. Certainly not enough to really have much of a conversation about that, I guess. But Yeah. I guess that's just, I mean, that's why we're doing this in part. How much is an attention? How much is, let's, you know, mind control the masses? How much is like, I want to make art? How much is like completely unintentional? And how much is stupid decisions? All of these things factor in, which is what makes it all fascinating.
So I've got another random thread here, and I didn't pull at it too hard, but I feel like there's something to it that might be worth someone else looking into, or I don't know if we ever revisit this, but a theme. Well, I guess there are a few more.
Three more poo movies, excuse me. Two more that are, I guess, well, they're all kind of just directly connected, I guess, but. Go ahead. I was just saying the next one, I think, goes back to an anthology. Like three story thing.
Oh, and then I hate anthologies.
Okay. Yeah, sorry, that's gonna be Piglets. I just, when I looked, it was to see if there was like a connection to what we were talking about, like with family.
And that's a very direct to video feel. Anthologies are.
And it went to theaters again. And yeah. So sorry, your thread.
Yeah. What was the other thread? Oh, so the original premise of this movie, before it turns into a MK Ultra gaslighting extravaganza. Really, it starts with Eeyore's house is destroyed, and it's destroyed by Tigger because Tigger's restless as usual, and he basically causes a boulder to fall onto Eeyore's house and it crushes it. But as soon as they start mentioning that, I couldn't get it out of my mind about the concept of like a house of the Zodiac, and like a house being crushed kind of represents the passing of a house. Like when a house falls, it basically means that sign has, you know, left the current cycle, and it's now ushering in like this new astrological cycle. And Eeyore very directly references Capricorn. Like if you look at the attributes, like the astrological attributes, like personality type, it all matches up as Capricorn with Eeyore. But if you don't believe in the like the personality aspect of astrology, and you are into like the zodiac aspect, out of all the astrological signs, it still seems like Capricorn would match up with Eeyore, even though he's a donkey and the Capricorn's a goat. They both are similar in terms of like digestion cycle and whatnot. So I mean, if you had to like put him into a specific bucket, he would be Capricorn. So now all of a sudden I'm thinking this movie starts out with the fall of Capricorn. And that's where I ended, because I could only focus on so many different threads. But I feel that if we keep going with this, maybe in the next movie, like another house falls. Cause in the first one, someone else's house falls. I can't remember whose that was.
It might have been Eeyore again. No, Piglet. Piglet has house problems.
Piglet's house. Okay, so now you've got whatever the Zodiac might represent for the pig, which now we're getting into sort of sidereal or like Eastern astrology. But first you have the fall of the house of the pig. Now you have the fall of the house of the donkey / Capricorn. So maybe this is a theme if another house falls.
I think, going on hazy memories, because I have not watched that beloved 2011 film, my beloved for me, but I want to say Al has some house problems. So maybe Al is next.
Well, I mean, I'm just saying, these are just Rabbit thoughts. Might but... have some.
No, Rabbit gets poo stuck in his door. That's what happens in the first.
The whole premise, though, that like a house falls, and that's where this movie starts and ends, because at the end of it, they bring the house back, right? They rebuild the house of Capricorn at the end of this movie. If Eeyore represents Capricorn, I'm not 100% on that, but all the pieces just kind of fit into place for that.
Yeah. Oh, the other thing that I did, and this is where I didn't get all the way on your MK ideas, but I did start at least thinking about Midnight Cowboy a little bit, which I guess is a small scale version of that sort of thing. but yeah, as I'm watching it, I'm increasingly just in my mind replacing Tigger's bounce with, you know, another word. Starts with an F, isn't good in polite company. So I'm watching the whole movie, you know, do you want to bounce with me? I'm like, forward, dude. so I mean, maybe I'm more puerile in that sense, but yeah, I'm saying there's just the whole movie, like putting just my mind's like putting that into all the songs and all the dialogue, which makes, you know, Tigger seem like very smutty. So, what word would you replace bounce with? You know,
I assume that he's just on meth. And every time he says bounce, that's just him taking another hit off of the meth pipe.
Oh, and Kanga's a nudist. I also wrote that down. Rue wears clothes.
The Kanga and the Rue thing, like, I don't want to go too deep into that tangent, but it blows. Like, I want to understand, did Rue come from Kanga? Like, in this world, or do they think, does Kanga think that she gave birth? Or anyway, I'll stop here. There'll be plenty of opportunities.
I'm sure one of the sequels will get into that. And I do think the Heffalump movie, if I remember correctly, like, really focuses on Rue, so you'll have your chance.
Yeah, I think they actually show the full birthing process in that movie, if I recall.
Like that, like that movie from the 50s, yeah. Except it's complete, it's animated and you know, excruciating detail. One more thing, just since in A Bug's Life, the whole story was, we have to get ready for winter, and we have to get ready for our winter and the grasshoppers, and then we have to get ready to defend ourselves because the grasshoppers were in here. They just forget about it completely, and Rabbit bursts in the door and tells them a bunch of idiots because they didn't prepare for winter. So just since A Bug's Life was like 3 or 4 movies ago, that kind of, I noticed that.
You know, that was part of the premise in one of the original ones, and this one, they just go right into winter and they don't mention it. So you just assume that we've already learned that lesson, so now we don't need to learn it again. That's happening in like the background of all this. But what does stand out in that same context is that Pooh like absolutely decimates or tries to steal all the honey out of this huge hive of bees, and then immediately goes into winter. And I'm just like, man, he killed that entire colony. Like, he took all the honey out. And then Tigger goes, and Tigger uses the honey to put together this fake house for his fake family that he was gaslit into, you know, constructing. So now those bees are really gone. Like, those bees are dead forever. And then winter comes and they have nothing to keep the entire colony alive.
If I were Tigger's family, by the way, I would take the new living room as an insult, not as a as hospitality. Go stay in there. No. The were as bad as Eeyore's house, yeah.
I've got a few more. I've got one thing that's surprised, and maybe they touched on this in the first movie. I don't remember it, but Pooh gets hurt by the bees. He actually gets stung by the bees in this one, and like all of a sudden, I'm imagining, could bees kill Pooh? Like, can they die from anaphylactic shock the same way that Macaulay Culkin does in My Girl? Could that happen to any of the characters in Pooh?
Spoiler alert, I haven't seen My Girl.
Oh, sorry about that.
No, I think I've heard that before.
That is a true spoiler. Like, that's the big payoff, is right, that Macaulay Culkin dies from a bee sting.
He sees dead people, yes. He sees himself. Where were we? Pooh feeling pain. Of course, these folks do rip. I mean, it's like Woody in Toy Story 2. They might rip or tear sometimes, and they're just like, oh no, my stuff has fallen out, you know?
That one was creepy in the very first one.
Yeah. So is it just the idea? Maybe it's the sound. He hates the sound of bees. I often how do you tell this to someone? My father-in-law has an electric razor, and I cannot stand to be in the room when he uses it. Like, if he starts, I'll just, like, whatever I'm doing, I'll probably just walk out of the room until I hear the buzzing stop. So, yes, if anyone wants to MK Ultra me, get electric razors near my ears, and I'll break, like, quickly.
There's a name for that, and I think I'm already wrong because it doesn't sound right in my head, but I think it's called misophonia. And it's basically when you develop a repulsive reaction to a certain sound and not. I mean, maybe MK Ultra wise, but there's
programming wise, I can tell you exactly how that happened. I was 6 years old at the barber, and he accidentally cut my earlobe, and it bled like crazy.
There you
go. It didn't even hurt that much, right? But now, when I get my hair cut, when the clippers come around my ear, I'll feel this little spasm in my lower left back. And that spasm, the lower left back, actually, when I was like around age 30, it was actually kind of a big problem. Like, I was going to acupuncture and having people like shoot like little electrodes through it. It's recently, it's been mostly okay, but yeah, I'm like,
well, that's the Disney programming. The Disney programming is taking over since you're watching every single theatrical release. So it's untold what's going to replace those spasms. It'll probably be worse, but that's probably why the spasms are leaving your body now. There's no room for that original programming anymore.
joke appreciated, but I think I'm going to blame that on personal meditation techniques.
Okay.
But yeah, and losing 10 kilos probably helped a lot too. So, but no, I did. It is fun to think that watching every Disney movie in a row as we are will get rid of some problems and cause brand new worse ones.
They would prefer that you attribute all of that to your own doing, so that it works for everybody. Win-win.
No. But no, with that sound thing, it is interesting. I can very much track like why that is, you know, the event that made it happen. And you know, it's like, I know it's like, wouldn't it be cool just to drop that, but you can't really. It's too under the surface, you know. Like, I'll try and like not, you know, can I like relax enough to not have my back spasm? Cause I'll hold the barber's chair when the clipper's around. So he's not like doing that. And then I do like twitch and like get cut, you know?
Yeah.
That's the thing. It's like the reaction is making it way more likely for it to happen again.
Well, and I guess one of the solutions, but Pooh does this in the movie where when he first tries to get the honey and he gets stung, then he sings this song Lullaby. And this is one of those examples. Like, I couldn't imagine someone listening to this on the soundtrack. Like, let me throw on Lullaby and drive to work. Like, it would creep me out if someone was listening to this outside of the movie, but Lullaby. Apparently
Eisner was.
Well, he was. And, well, he was a creeper, but I think that Lullaby is a good example of hypnotic suggestion. Like who is literally using hypnosis to lull these bees outside of their, you know, defensive state so that he can move in and steal all their honey. So the entire colony dies that winter, which happens like 15 minutes later. But just another example of them showing you real programming techniques within a movie that's already about gaslighting.
Yeah. And one of the reasons I like the 2011 one again is I think the dialogue is really well written, and a lot of the ways it's well written are in kind of NLP sort of ways. And I think this maybe like what you just said is kind of that with the singing, the hypnotic suggestion for yourself, right? So I mean, you can do use those techniques on yourself too if you want.
Oh god, now I'm brainstorming a Winnie the Pooh guided NLP training seminar, because you can do that, right? Like, we could just
yeah. Oh yeah, yeah, yeah.
Learn NLP with Winnie the Pooh.
Well, we keep going on different tangents, but I've been meaning to bring up like the Tao of Pooh a little bit. That was a popular book. It's like, is Pooh the one person resisting programming, or is he completely 100% into it? Because he don't care. Is the programming just think about honey and nothing else? And he's like 100% deep.
Oh, he's a fish in water. That's what he is.
Yeah, this maybe he's number one, you know, in the village.
Well, he's, I guess 11. Yeah,
you know, he's number two, like the real number two. Excuse me, Christopher Robin, I guess, is one. Well, that's the fun thing, because
In the first movie, right, he loses an arm, doesn't he? Like, he almost loses an arm. Like, his entrails are coming out, and it's just like, woo-hoo, you know what I mean? Like, he couldn't care less, man. And I feel like that would be the pinnacle of MKUltra programming, is that you could just start removing someone's entrails, and they would just be like, oh, that's fine.
So what state does that put him in? A state of perfection, someone else's perfection, a state of hell? Yeah. How does Pooh actually feel? I don't know. I guess he feels chill. Is that good?
Yeah. Is being an MK Ultra mind control slave, is that just a pure state of Zen where you are fully detached from any outcomes? Like, isn't that ultimately the goal of enlightenment?
I guess it's just do it to yourself is better. Maybe that's what ultimately what, you know, meditation things are anyway, right? You're MK altering yourself. Like I say, I make my own brainwashing music. I was thinking after I said that last time too, well, I am using, you know, a lot of patches and things that other people program. So you could argue, I always tweak them to how they sound good to me, but I am, you know, someone else's brain trust is also entering that. I can't completely say it's, you know, just my own thing, I guess.
Well, yeah, there's always parameters. You're also limited to the range of human hearing, I think, right? Because even psychoacoustics, they still rely on audible frequencies. They just manipulate it in ways that it, like, for example, like you can make something sound like there's bass, even if there's no bass, using psychoacoustics, right?
Yeah. Or you just, you know, you equalize it to do that. So what that's something I'll do a lot, just crank up the bass on like a drone just to make it rumble more, you know, because I like the rumble, you know. Of course, someone else programmed it to a certain extent. I guess it's kind of like the AI thing. So, you know, someone produced and not the AI. And then I'm just tweaking it a little past that. So I feel like I own it more.
Well, I mean, if you want to wire that all the way back to the original, like the fact that we're all locked into this 440 instead of 432, right? That is the similar aspect of like any music that you ever make. It's still made in the confines of 440, assuming that you've tuned whatever your instrument is so that A is at 440 hertz. But once you've done that, like you're locked into that particular like sound scale.
Well, actually, one of the synthesizers I have, it's an iPad one, and it does allow me to put, so I'll do the binaural thing. I'll record two of the same drones, maybe just slowly turn in a modulation knob or something. But one of them I always set at 432, and the other one's like a little bit offset. If it's a little darker, I'll put it a little under. If it's a little brighter, I mean, just music wise, I'll put it a little higher, you know? And does that actually do anything? I don't know. But I've read books about it. I've heard people talk about 432. Sure, I'll try that. Now, the other synthesizers I'm using are probably set at 440. So I'm like, does that mean the benefit of the 432 music is still in there?
I mean, my thought on that is that they used to take that so seriously that they would outlaw certain types of music and certain scales. I think like Phrygian scales were like completely banned. Like Pythagoras took a big stand against certain modes where like you weren't even allowed to play in those modes because they considered that it would cause unrest in society. It would cause all sorts of delinquent behavior. So I think the real power behind 440 and 432 might be less of an individual scale. I think it becomes more on like a bigger national, or at least like a regional scale. Like what if everyone in the state of Florida only listened to 432 and then everyone in the other states listened to like 440? That's where you might actually see real difference in the way that societies react and shape and change. Although we would never really know because 440 rules supreme. Like every conventional instrument and guide to tuning, and if you buy any off the rack analog gear, they're all going to be tuned to 440, or at least direct you to tune it to 440.
The music I make now, especially with guitars, I tuned a Day Tripper actually, but 10 years ago I just completely tuned by ear. I just tune all my instruments in tune with each other and record songs, and I've noticed they're slightly lower than most other music. Like if I want to play along with my old music, I have to detune my guitar a bit. Jimi Hendrix, you have to detune your guitar to play with Hendrix most of the time.
Right, and that's the whole premise of why 440 was ushered in, was to give everyone a very specific and easy to tune to number. And the unfortunate aspect is that 440 is easy to tune instruments to, but it's not easy to tune a voice to. And that's where voices were easier to tune to 432. And that's where you get into like the cymatics. I don't know how deep we've gone on that before. I'm sure it's come up more than a few times.
I'm just thinking, yeah, and especially in rock music, because in classical before, if you find archival recordings from the 20s, I guess you are hearing them in 432. That was in the 30s when that change was made.
Correct. And it was by I mean, World War II ultimately had a very huge impact on that 432 versus 440. And one of the things is that before there was that standard, if you were going on tour and you were going around Europe, there's a very good chance that as you went from theater to theater to theater, you'd have to be constantly retuning your instruments. And then at a certain point, they realized, well, we'll just keep the band, you know, and all, like we'll keep the orchestra in the city because that way they know the tuning and they know how it all works. And you don't have to string or retune anything. And it'll just be the singers that travel around. But now the singers are like used to singing in a certain tone, certain frequency. And then if they go to another theater and that theater is tuned a little bit differently, now they got to change what they've learned, you know, vocally. And A, it doesn't work always as well. They might need more warm up and practice, but also it causes lots of irritation in the throat because they've kind of like trained their throat to feel a certain way. And then you keep bouncing around. And that's where the cymatics come in, where you see those videos where they'll put like sand on a plate and they'll play different frequencies, and those frequencies make different shapes. And if you look at the shape of 432, it kind of makes like a nice kaleidoscope, you know, symmetrical geometric pattern. And 440 has one that's a lot more like disharmonious. It almost looks like a visual cacophony. And if you imagine that is almost like a spiked ball that now is like being reproduced in your throat. So that was the whole reason that opera singers were so in favor of 432 versus the 440, even outside of the mind control aspects.
Yeah. So in classical, it's extremely important, you know, because everything has to be tempered, as they say, and now it's tempered to a different place. If you're sitting with a guitar and singing, I think people, and you're not specifically using a tuner, I think you tend to end up in 432 is my theory. You know, I don't really know how to sit there and like gauge old music, you know, Hendrix or music I used to make, and there's some Beatles songs I think they just tune by ear. So when they tune by ear, but yeah.
Well, also the one thing that it kind of shoots a hole in some of these like conspiracy theories about 432 and 440, and that's that it's not like anyone is writing a song and they just play A the whole time. They just go A, you know what I mean? So you're never actually just going to get 432.
Like the binaural beat, you do. Literally, there's a track on there on both speakers where you're just playing A.
Fair point. Well, that's a very, I mean, I guess I'm thinking more of like a Jimi Hendrix style.
Conventional music,
your guitar to 432, the second you bend the wire just a little bit with your finger, like you're going to get the 440 in there. And if you play a chord, like you're not getting 432 anymore. Now you're getting a composite chord that would be, you know, like a summation of all these different components. So it's like, the 432 in theory and on that little cymatic pattern makes all the sense in the world. But once you actually introduce that into the real world and someone playing an instrument, like it feels like 432 doesn't even exist at that point.
Yeah, I guess going farther in that direction, in an orchestra, one, a guitar is never dead in tune. A stringed instrument is never 100% in tune. In an orchestra, the cello player, use that because I play cello, is never exactly playing the note, and then you're usually using vibrato too. So
exactly, and the vibrato is literally like you're not at 432, you're at like 428 to 436, and it just keeps fluctuating between those depending on what you're doing with your fingers and everything else.
Although there is a school of thought that the Bach cello suites, which are the solo cello pieces that somehow end up sounding like organ music, the people who want to play it like authentically, one, they're playing on gut strings and that's weird and two, they use no vibrato playing those, so I wonder if that has anything to do with the organ thing. When I play them, I don't want to think about, I'm a modern player, so I just don't want to think too hard about not using vibrato. There's times you don't. Anyway, that's not interesting. I did want to read a news article that came that I thought about. I read it 2 days ago. Yeah, it's Monday, April 8th. It's on CNN, sorry. But Chechnya bans all music deemed too fast or slow. Authorities in the Russian Republic of Chechnya have announced a ban on music, like the same thing, vocal and choreographic compositions to a tempo ranging from 80 to 116 beats per minute. So if it's slower than 80 or faster than 116, I guess you get arrested or fined now or something.
You know what's nuts, though, is that almost every default tempo for electronic DAWs or gear, it tends to be 120 BPM. So that's out of walking the box.
Pace, right. They don't want walking pace.
Right. That's crazy.
I will say GarageBand will set it at 110. So
they're in the clear.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's what military cadence is also, is typically 120 BPM.
Maybe they want to just save that for themselves then.
Right. So, everyone just starts walking a little bit slower.
once you join the military, now we pump you up a little bit. It's like the opera singer. You push them a little past the range they're comfortable with now.
Right. And now if you have to sick the military on the civilians, the military knows how to operate at a slightly higher frequency because they have been marching and thinking and listening at 120 BPM and you've been limited to what, 118? So maybe those extra BPMs is all the difference.
Dragging your butt. Excuse me. I think I said bus. Anyway, I guess since this movie theoretically went into theaters for music, it's fine that we've been talking about music for the past 20 minutes, but
Yeah, I've got a few other observations before we wrap this one up.
Hit them.
So the final scene that I was talking about before that was really interesting is that Pooh starts singing about his family tree, and it goes through like this whole litany of different little scenes of like what he's conceptualizing his family tree to be like comprised of. So first there's a there's like the Birth of Venus painting, but it's got like a female Tigger like hiding her bosom and everything. So I was like, okay, that's interesting. Then they show like a full redneck square dancing jug band style, like the Country Bears style Tiggers. Then they show a Brady Bunch Tiggers, followed by a Partridge Family Tiggers. Then there's a scene where I think the quote is like skinny, tiny, thin little Tiggers. And it's basically like a bunch of models, like Kate Moss style models that are all Tigger, but like wearing like real like scantily clothed. Then there's an alien Tigger that's meeting an astronaut Tigger. And then they have a Jerry Springer Tigger on a show called Tigger Talk. And then they show the face of the Sphinx being Tigger and it falls off, which is its own like really interesting observation. Like they baked in that concept that the Sphinx used to have a face and then it changed. Then immediately after that is a flat Earth reference where they actually show water falling off the edge of the Earth. Then it shows someone called Tiggerella, who's like a Marilyn Monroe Tigger, and then they even show like the air blowing up the dress, and then Tiggerella has to like hold the dress down like all sexy style. So that was the coolest freaking like sequence of events in this entire movie, and that was the one part that it no longer had that timeless look to it. Like it had a more modern digital look, but I wasn't expecting it, and it just like came out of nowhere, and it felt like an awesome unexpected gift, like a treat.
Yeah, that's where it also might be part of the office culture thing just seeping into anyone and everywhere and Disney, because Aladdin, all the genie stuff like really took off. I mean, that's one of the reasons that that you cited that as being one of the reasons that movie is so successful. Hercules tried to do a little bit again, so maybe once it was going theatrical, they're like, let's add some bling. I mean, I don't know if that was added later, but I have a feeling it might have been.
It had that feeling to it because that took a lot more effort, you know, production wise compared to everything that led up to that. But also this feeds back into the like, let's keep Tigger programmed, because even when Tigger starts thinking about what his family is, all his references are movies and TV. Like there's not a single Tiger in the Wild in any of that, you know, it's all from Disney IP and from other like pop culture IP. So I think it just helps paint that same picture that Tigger is like this mind control victim, because he has no frame of reference to the real world. It's all manufactured.
Hey, yeah. I just mentioned playing cello. I started playing in the fourth grade, 9 years old or whatever. And they're like, okay, we're all doing band and strings next year. Write down the three instruments you want. I wrote down cello because I had just seen the James Bond movie, The Living Daylights, in which they escape on a cello case. And I'd seen Ghostbusters like probably 30 times, right? So I guess a cello then.
You were programmed into thinking that and you thought it was your decision. And it really wasn't. Like it's That's not right. And it's not that someone sat down and they were like, we're going to make Matt play the cello. It was more like, hey, we're going to send out this programming and the people that are most susceptible to it will fall in line and they'll ask to play the cello instead of, you know, the jaw harp or something else that's not even on the list.
So blame, we'll blame Sigourney Weaver and whoever the Bond girl was. I think she was a cello player. Maybe that's me first liking girls. Hey, that's a cool instrument. I don't know.
Girls really find this hot. I should play the cello. They'll love it. Screw this guitar thing.
When I was younger, I don't think I ever got any from playing guitar, but I did play cello a few times.
Oh, God. Band camp? One time in band camp?
No, I'm talking like playing the show and then like leaving after. This is like in my 20s. No, I was playing a mic'd cello, not electric cello, but a mic'd cello for Jesus Christ Superstar. And the girl like that. So that was cool. They had, you know, they had the three or four piece rock band on stage. It's like a jazz, like a bohemian jazz club thing where we're next to the stage, like a mini orchestra, like a mic'd. It was fun.
Yeah, I bet. It sounds like it was a
party scene. Yeah. I think they started doing those regularly too, but that's the point I moved to Japan, so I didn't keep doing that. You said a couple more points. Does that suggest you got one more?
I mean, that was the most of it towards the end. There was a really interesting combination of all of a sudden modern pop culture references in this timeless Winnie the Pooh production. And then again, that went at the very end, Christopher Robbins like laughs. They laugh when he finds out what they've been trying to do this whole time, and they've been trying to find Tigger's family. Just like the way that this freaking Archon laughs at these creations of his is so sadistic that, again, this is like cementing my idea that Christopher Robin is like an incredibly evil Archon / Antichrist.
So this was playing in your nightmares last night?
Dude, I sleep like a baby. Okay. The only nightmares I have is the military is coming back to make me go back through boot camp and, you know, enlist and work like a really horrible job again. That's like the only reoccurring nightmare that I have.
I guess that's like I have a test again nightmare or something.
Yeah, it's sort of like that, but a lot more running.
Or I just have a lot of them trying to move across town and I'm just making really bad progress of it. And with
lots it's not true. I do have one other reoccurring, and I don't know how comfortable I am sharing my reoccurring nightmares on an episode about MK Ultra where we're bad mouthing Disney. It's almost just like telling them, here's where here's my Achilles heel. But I have this weird reoccurring nightmare where I go somewhere and I park my car, and when I come back out, I can't find my car, and I'm just walking for like what feels like hours or days, and I'm like exhausted to the point where I'll wake up and I will feel so tired because I've been walking so long in my nightmare. So I know it's not as scary as other people's nightmares, but man, like it really triggers me. Like I can't ever find my car in my dreams.
Well, that's kind of nicer when if that's the worst you got coming, right?
It's the worst I got coming. Yeah.
Better than like endless spiders, I guess. I don't know.
Well, until I see a woman walk by in a polka dot dress, and then it's just like pure nightmare fuel.
I might have mentioned before. I'm not claiming any strong astral projection skills, but occasionally I do find myself like checking things and then realizing that was not the real thing. Like I'll check the clock and it looks okay, by the way. I can read the number and fortunately my internal clock's good, so when I do wake up I'm usually like maybe 20 minutes off in either direction, so that's kind of nice. But yeah, I thought George Lucas was dead for a week not long ago because I read the news on my astral iPad, I think. I did see, for realsy, the O.J. Simpson has finally slipped off this marital coil. That just seemed
weird. Yeah, I heard he was just about to find the killer, too, but now I'll never know.
I know. But yeah, I was like, that feels like some end of an era somehow. I don't know why. I guess that's the last time everybody watched TV at the same time.
I saw a really nice, subtle meme about this where someone just had a picture of a jug of orange juice and the expiration date was today's date. And there was like no other caption or explanation. And I wonder how many people like got that was what that was about. And it felt like, I don't know, it was like chef's kiss.
I'm not going to say I'm smart enough that I would have figured it out if I hadn't seen the news.
I had to stare. I had to stare like, why are there all these likes on a freaking, oh, I get it.
I guess we will wrap it up then, unless you got something else you want to toss in. I guess I'll read my last note, which I wrote is, I'll disremember you. And I don't remember why I wrote
the
that.
Movie. I don't know. I think I'll remember this one because of how strong the gaslighting aspect was. This one stands out as being very unique to me in how everyone was on board from the first hint of like, let's lie to poor Tigger about his family. Let's gaslight him into thinking his family knows about him, all the way to the point of dressing up and acting like his family. I don't know.
Makes a 3-year-old feel smart, because a 3-year-old can probably work out that's a bad plan, you know?
Maybe. I don't know. Can they?
Okay, good question. A 5-year-old? Can a 7-year-old? What age can you figure it out?
I think that if your only frame of reference is this movie, you would almost accept that this is a normal and a good thing to do, because why? Like these IP Disney characters, part of the like Disney idea is that they don't have bad intent. They might have horrible outcomes, but only the villains have bad intent. So even when a Disney IP character does something that has catastrophic effects, they're never really like the bad guy for doing it, all because of intent. Now, consider this movie. If Rue goes to Owl and everyone else in the town, and they're like, you know what? Let's screw with Tigger. Let's make him think that his family knows who he is and that they love him, and we're going to lie about it, and we're going to dress up.
Basically, we're going to play.
Like, all of a sudden, it takes on like a very nasty connotation, but nothing at all in the entire movie has changed, other than when Rue goes and sees Owl, he just says, hey, let's do this on purpose, instead of saying, hey, let's do this to help him. That's the only thing that would change. And now all of a sudden, the movie is like horrible, right?
Well, there's no real catharsis at the end, is there any, either? I mean, Tigger's got a Band-Aid. He might be more depressed than Eeyore again next week, you know?
Right, because Rue still has a real mom, right? That's where the whole thing came from.
So it's not like they've actually solved the problem at all. They've just added some extra trauma to the
depression. I want to see Rue get kidnapped, and he gets put in the 200-acre forest that's not connected to the 100-acre forest. And when he's like, I want to go back to my mom, I want to go back to Kang, and they're like, what do you mean? That, like, we're your family now. Like, this is your family, right? Isn't that the same excuse that you gave to Tigger so that he wouldn't have to find his family? So doesn't that just always apply, that as soon as you get kidnapped, whoever your captors are, that's your new family? I mean, this is Dr. Sleep.
yeah, I guess so. I don't know. You want to throw out what you're up to in the recents?
Chosenone.com is wrapping up now. If you're watching this and I put it on YouTube, you're probably now going to be one of supporting me at adultoccult.com, which is a very non-kid friendly comic series that is fully adult, very explicit. It shows incredibly sexual situations. It's where erotica meets esoterica, and I'm branching out. I'm trying all the different things, and this one's actually has quite a nice little like rumble about it. Like, I did zero promotion of this particular one. I just got the domain name and I put up like a Kickstarter like coming soon page and posted like two or three times about it. I've been actively promoting everything else I've been doing, and this one's already got like over 200 people that are ready to like sign up and back it and everything. So I've really got high hopes that, and it's called Illuminati. That's the name of the comic series. It's four different issues. Each issue is 20 pages. So that's over 80 pages of completely original, conspiratorial, esoteric, erotic content from Paranoid American, adultoccult.com.
All right. One of the reasons I tossed that to you is also, I just want to have a quick scan on the Heffalump movie, which does involve Rue leaving the 100-acre wood and finding an outside creature. So it doesn't look like we get the plot you were just describing. Just when, well, you're saying, I was like, something's familiar there.
This is triggering me again, because this is the Johnny Gosch story, right? Is that you get an MK Ultra, you know, victim, and you send them out to procure more victims. Like, it's the perfect scam.
That's the plot. So we should have something to talk about when we get there.
Yeah, we'll do it.
As for me, I'll throw out, I've been talking music, so I'll throw out my music site again this week, which is rovingsagemedia.bandcamp.com. I have made an insane amount of music for reasons I don't know. I probably got programmed by some movie in the 80s to do it, and now there's like 50 albums there. So
keep them coming, man.
Yeah. It is weird that I don't see, unlike the ear thing, I don't know what programmed that, because I do feel compelled. I'll get depressed if I haven't made a song for a while. So, and then I just for no other reason have to go make it, you know? So where does that come from? I guess that's better than a lot of things you can be programmed to do. So you got to go make a song. That works. That's better than, say, you know, Manson's urges.
Well, that's just the virus spreading. That's all that is.
Yeah. The virus is spreading through 100-acre wood and beyond to your home.
To break on through that Easter shell, bathtub yeah. Rope on the 35th degree, and back across that edge green sea. pimp lies and goodbye to cheese. I'm a company man and I don't take no guff. There's nothing here to see. You see, I smell the weird electricity. I sink in Lake Amphilly. Control the facets of opposition. Careful where you open your mind. Be careful where you open your mind.